You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, SpyCast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about SpyCast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make SpyCast better, and you can help. We're joined today by Michael Brady, who's a retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel and former career intelligence officer. He's performed a wide variety of tactical and strategic intelligence functions, including long-range surveillance, interrogation, intelligence analysis, and collections management. His areas of expertise and research include threats to the homeland, intelligence collection systems and programs, intelligence analysis, and intelligence support to national policymaking. He's also a former contributor to the Asia Times, where he wrote on intelligence and security issues in the region. Michael currently teaches graduate and undergraduate courses at the Citadel as a faculty member in their Department of Intelligence and Security Studies. He is also a novelist, and his latest book, Into the Shadows Assassination Corps, is out now. So welcome, Michael. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at SpyCast.
Vince, thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be with you.
So you spent a career in intelligence. For a lot of people, when someone who decided to do that for a big part of their life, mm-hmm. I want to ask the question, what drove you in this direction? What made you decide to do a career in intelligence? Because a lot of people, when they're going into the military, intelligence for, they want to be infantry or the tankers or special forces. Intel, especially, not to date you, but especially when you joined the Army, right. It didn't necessarily have the same kind of mystique and prestige that it does mm-hmm. today, certainly going back to early 1990s.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I think there were two things that drove me. I think the first was The Hunt for Red October by Tom Clancy. I was a teenager at the time. I have to be honest, I've said this before. When I read that, I said, oh, that would be really cool if I became an intelligence officer and I was able to dig up things and figure out what the adversary was doing, what is our enemy doing. And I think the second thing that really drove me was, need. I was compelled to serve the country. And, we had the Russian horde is what I used to call it. And, I wanted to be stationed in Germany and do the full to gap scenario. And so it was those two factors that really over a period of a few years led me to go into the Citadel, become an intelligence officer, and do 20 years.
And you got there just in time not to care about the full to gap scenario anymore. I think you graduated in 1990, which is a quite exciting time to be joining the profession. This is a time of massive transition during this. Was it obvious as a young intelligence officer that the world was changing?
No. At least from my perspective, it was not. I was a young lieutenant. My first assignment was with Echo Company, 51st Infantry, long-range surveillance. And so we were hoping to go over in the desert. I was assigned to 5th Corps. That corps did not deploy. I think it was a much simpler time back then because you really you had the Russians. But then when we came back from the war with Iraq, after the liberation of Kuwait, I think the Army and the nation found itself wondering what is going on here. We've got the collapse of the Soviet Union. Things are supposed to be looking rosy, but we've got things like Somalia going on. We've got things like the Balkan conflict and some others. And so I think a lot of us, especially when you're younger, you're focused on a career. You're focused on being the best lieutenant you can be, the best platoon leader you can be. Those strategic issues kind of get lost as a young officer. There was a period of time probably for many, many years where I didn't know where I was going to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's a dramatic refocus. You're talking about the fold the gap scenario, and then you're all of a sudden in the 90s, you're thinking low intensity conflict, you're thinking asymmetrical warfare, yeah. peacekeeping operations.
Yeah, I mean, and you're thinking Somalia, you know, yeah. you're thinking places like that. Where the mission is much different than what we use, you know, when we talk about conventional combat. And so it was a learning period for the Army. It was a learning period as an intelligence officer. Prior to that, I spent much of my training and reading on the Soviet Union, you know, that. But when that went away, I had to figure out, okay, what do I read about now? Is it Africa?
Right.
Is it the Middle East? Southeast Asia? You don't know.
You kept going east, though, right? You went to Asia.
I did. Yeah.
I mean, was that a conscious shift of looking at some of the emerging threats in Asia? Did you say that as partially a interest, but also a career choice?
Yeah.
To start looking at East Asia?
Yeah. I was blessed. I was able to become a strategic intelligence officer just before 9/11. And so one of the things that I thought was going to happen prior to 9/11 was the rise of Asia, particularly the Chinese, from an economic and a political and a military perspective. I don't count or consider the Chinese now a threat. They are a strategic competitor. They are an economic power. They are rivaling the United States. But back then, I looked at the world and I thought what was happening was, and it was most likely the rise of China, just because of the population shifts, the demographics, the economics, and so I really wanted to start, you know, putting my interest at the strategic level towards that region.
Well, you have that, you know, thorn in their eye sitting right off of the Chinese mainland. I mean, I read you wrote your classified master's thesis
on Taiwan,
on the PRC in Taiwan, and that relationship. How dated is that, or is that still basically an issue? I mean, you obviously can't talk about it because it is a classified thesis, but the idea of Taiwan was something I, you know, kind of came of age thinking about was going to be the next flashpoint.
Yeah.
And the South China Sea and all the things about the, mm-hmm. you know, denial of the region for us and everything else. That seems to have cooled a little bit, but every so often there'll be some kind of referendum in Taiwan.
Yes. Yeah.
And then everyone goes, oh, not again.
Yes. And it keeps us guessing, doesn't it? We don't really know. I mean, it seems like, you know, every few years, you know, the tide shifts just a little bit where it's almost, you know, 50-50 split in terms of what the people of Taiwan want to do. So we'll see. I mean, I think it's certainly a flashpoint, like you mentioned. But I think right now the real concern is the South China Sea, the militarization of the South China Sea, and so we'll see how things progress in that regard. So
that's the mantra as well. We'll see.
Yes. Yeah. We'll see. Let's hope some calm heads prevail. I mean, you know, the thing is, I think what's important for us is to really understand what the Chinese are trying to do in the South China Sea. You know, I mean, there's a lot of debate on that. You know, I took some flack about a year or two ago where I wrote about what's driving the Chinese into the South China Sea. And if you listen to a lot of national security experts or some other folks, they'll say, well, a big part of it is that, you know, they want to extend their military. You know, they want to do the A2, the denial program that they've got in place right now, area denial campaign. And so a lot of conventional thought is that they're in there to expand their military capabilities. I look at it from a different perspective, which I think a lot of people in intelligence are starting to come around to, and that is they're there for the resources. So if you look at the South China Sea and you look at why they're there, you've got to understand oil and the fisheries, you know, especially with China consuming 25% of the world's fish catch.
That seems almost more problematic because other countries want the resources there as well.
Yeah, you've got some competition there.
Yeah, I mean, down the road, I mean, I have a question here, but we can talk, it was more novel related, and we can talk about that here, but I'll bring it up to the top of something you actually point out in this novel is that we now have some somewhat strange bedfellows in East Asia. I mean, former enemies, like Vietnamese
and then
countries you wouldn't normally think of as being key intelligence allies, like Indonesia and other places. How has this world changed in the last 15 years about all of a sudden we're working very closely with non-traditional allies in the region?
Well, we're almost being forced to, you know. I mean, you know, I think one of the things, if you look at American history, and I'm certainly not a historian by trade, but when you take a look at, you know, we're always focused on one or two threats. And so all of the other things that are going on in the world are secondary. So much of our effort, you know, went into the Soviet Union. If you look at what's happened since 9/11, most of our efforts have been on the counterterrorism front. particularly focused on the Middle East. But now that you've got potential flashpoints like the South China Sea, you know, we're going to have to start partnering with countries like Vietnam. Vietnam is a claimant to the South China Sea. Now, I'm not advocating that we go in there and solve the problem for the claimants. As long as we focus on our freedom of navigation, I'm happy. But we will have to work with them and share intel, whereas 20 or 30 years ago, they were an adversary. So it's really interesting how the world is developing.
Well, it's just the changing dynamics, because Vietnam's biggest sugar daddy during the whole decades was China.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It wasn't the Soviets. It was right. China. And all of a sudden, it making a lot of people nervous in that region.
Well, it is. But the thing is, too, if you look at some articles recently between the Chinese and the Vietnamese, they're now doing joint oil exploration. And so I think what'll happen is over time, you know, their focus on economic resources will probably bring them together rather than pulling them apart. So
let me ask you a couple of broad questions about military intelligence and being a military intelligence officer. I've met some great ones within the military, both when I was in the Army and after, and some not so great ones were bitter that they were an MI. They didn't really want to be. They got branch assigned. They wanted to be an armor officer.
Right.
You focused on the concept of what it means to be a military officer in the past, You wrote an article in 2000 kind of focusing on, you say, critical tasks. Like, what are some of the most important things that an intelligence officer in the military can do to be part of the broader kind of combat apparatus? Because I always looked at it, even when I was in, as the poor S2 or J2 having to schlep out and give us a briefing. We were bored to death.
Sure. There was no specificity in it, was there?
Well, the no specificity, and he always seemed to be an outsider, right?
Sure.
You know, he was jealous of the S3, really wanted to be in operations, and he was just kind of pissed off he had to give the weather report to a bunch of Joes.
Yeah.
It seems now things have become much more integrated. I mean, I'm a dinosaur. I'm going back to the 90s in my case. What are some of the key concepts, the key things that military intelligence officers, to give you an idea, we have a lot of listeners who are an MI themselves, sometimes are junior officers, sometimes civilians, sometimes there are people who are in grad school thinking about a career or, wanting one day to do military intelligence. If you had pieces of information or advice to give about what makes a good military intelligence officer, what would they be?
I would say first you have to understand the battle space. You know, you have to understand how the conditions on the ground impact friendly operations. You know, so it depends on, you know, where you're operating. I would also tell young officers or those who are interested in becoming intelligence officers to really pay close attention to the ground in both urban and rural areas, because those types of things will impact friendly operations. So one of the things I always try to do when I was a young officer a long time ago, I always joke with my students, it was about 10,000 years ago, was to visualize the battle space and to be able to articulate that vision to the commander so that he or she, back then, you know, he could make good decisions and create good operational plans that will be success. And the other thing, too, is that one of the things I learned a long time ago was, you know, always look at the perspective of the trigger puller. So whenever I got information, you know, Colonel North gave me some valuable advice many, many years ago when he said the first thing you should ask yourself is, who needs to know this? And it's not going to be me, with the emphasis on pushing information down to that soldier. And so I think a lot of times what I saw in my career at the tactical level a long time ago was an emphasis to, you know, sort of please the boss, please the staff, maybe the company commanders. But I think those of us who looked at it a little bit different, you know, may have been a little bit more successful because our focus was, let's get this information down to the trigger puller, and then we'll worry about the staff as things go. So that's what I would I would recommend to a new officer.
Well, that's looking great in the great direction of the tactical side.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what is the difference between tactical intelligence and really the big picture stuff, like what CIA is doing? Because not only is what I talk about the differences, but also, is it necessary for a lieutenant or even a company commander at the military intelligence level to think big picture also, to understand where they fit within the broad kind of overall military strategy, but even bigger than that, right? The overall grand strategy. I mean, David Petraeus talked about the strategic corporal as somebody that can really shit the bed for you if someone at that level doesn't understand what the big picture is.
Mm-hmm.
So I can understand a first lieutenant, you know, a platoon leader, maybe not having the geopolitical knowledge that they should, But mm-hmm. how important is it that they start trying to think that way?
Well, I think it's very important. I mean, you know, one of the things, one of the primary differences in my judgment between tactical level intelligence and that of strategic intelligence is really understanding the intent of our competitor or our threat. And so, you know, when you're a tactical intelligence officer, you're working on trying to identify the target so that a trigger puller can engage that target and take it out. When you are at the CIA and you are a strategic intelligence officer, what you're trying to do is figure out what is Putin's next move in the Baltics. How can we anticipate what he's going to do in the Baltics? And so I think that's one of the primary differences between military intelligence and then what we call strategic intelligence. I think it's very important for a young officer to understand the bigger picture, because he or she has a big role in it.
Right.
You know, if you look at some of the missteps we've had in Iraq over the years or in Afghanistan, those incidences that occurred really changed the picture, because everything that we do on the ground in Afghanistan, those Afghans are going to be looking at us going, are these people that we can trust? And so if a young officer understands the big picture of what we're trying to do, we're trying to, you know, get rid of the Taliban, we're trying to get rid of Al-Qaeda, and we're trying to help the Afghans have a stable working democracy or self-governance down the road. And if a young officer understands that, that should guide his or her actions on a daily basis.
I mean, that goes back to the concept of commander's intent, right?
Sure.
Which goes back to the Germans in World War II. If we denazify the idea of the German army in World War II, the United States military, especially the army, is completely modeled on the way the Germans take things. The idea is give somebody a job to do, then get out of their way.
Yeah.
But it's important to understand what the intent of the mission is.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think people get lost, especially with the military intelligence side, because it's so heady? It's not like a tanker where it's go kill those guys, take that territory.
Mm-hmm.
They get lost all up the chain at some point where they might not see it through to the big picture commander's intent.
Mm-hmm.
They might just go, well, the brigade commander care. Like, no.
Mm-hmm.
What is the chief of staff of the army thinking? What is the president thinking in this case?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to understand. I mean, a young officer still needs to really, really be good at his or her job at the tactical level. So they need to be spending a lot of time there. But what I would tell a young officer is, hey, look, when you get a chance, you know, in your off-duty hours, or if you're overseas somewhere and you're deployed, you know, read some books, you know, whether it's be about China, read some books from General Michael Hayden, get some perspective of the big picture, because ultimately those men and women are going to become captains. They're going to be then colonels,
right,
and they're going to be drafting policy and creating policy and executing policy in places around the world. So if they have a strong foundation early on, it'll make them more successful in the future.
We'll have more with Michael in a second, but first let me tell you about the Assassinations podcast. The assassination of President John F. Kennedy by Lee Harvey Oswald changed the course of history. But would things have turned out differently if Oswald wasn't successful in killing the president? Would President Kennedy have served a second term? Or would somebody else have tried to assassinate him? The new podcast, Assassins, from the Parcast Network, examines what happens when murder meets public officials. Assassination takes a deep dive into the life of some of the world's most infamous assassins to discover what motivated them to take such drastic measures. Hosts Bill and Kate examine these assassinations through the lens of both the target and the assassin, asking, did the assassin ultimately achieve his or her underlying objective? And if so, how did it change the world? New episodes come out every week. Check out the 3-part episode of John F. Kennedy right now and look for upcoming events on Malcolm X and even pop singer Selena. New episodes come out every Monday. So search and subscribe to Assassinations wherever you listen to podcasts. Again, that's Assassinations, or visit parcast.com/assassinations to start listening now. That's Parcast, parcast.com/assassinations to listen now. So you had an interesting job that I didn't mention in your bio because I want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. You were the director of the Presidential Emergency Operations Center in the mm-hmm. White House. Now, listeners, listen to the dates. From January 2001 until July 2002 under President George W. Bush. So you probably out there picked up on what important date is in the middle of that. So you were in the White House Operations Center on 9/11.
I was the director on 9/11. I was not sitting in the Operations Center. I was actually, I'd just come home because my wife had a stem cell transplant at Walter Reed Army Hospital. So, but yes, I was a director at the time of 9/11.
So you were dealing with that and your wife at the time as well?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, yeah. My wife, she unfortunately passed away, but she fought a hard fought for 4 years. She got stage 4 breast cancer, was diagnosed immediately in 2000, but she pulled a hard fight and and survived to 2004. So yeah, I had both those things going on. I will tell you though that the men and women who were part of the team really helped me out, and they did a marvelous job on 9/11. All I can say is they communicated with me, I communicated with them, and we were prepared to go if something were to happen to the White House. But other than that, I can't really talk about it. But yeah, it was two horrible situations for the nation and myself, but got through it. So. Yeah. It's all good.
Well, let me talk around it a little bit. I know mm-hmm. you can only say so much. Yeah. This is almost going to sound like a, you know, the sideline reporter at a football game where the coach has just led a team that got annihilated. How do you feel, right? Mm-hmm. They want to say, horrible. Why are you asking mm-hmm. me how I feel? How insane was it? How obviously you were prepared, you were trained for something like this. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you have, in intelligence, not having information is stressful. Right. It's the worst thing we can possibly find ourselves mm-hmm. in is lack of information. And there's a mm-hmm. lot of lack of information that day. So how crazy was it to try to understand what the world was looking at and the threats to the White House on that day?
Oh, it was crazy. I mean, there was a little bit of chaos in terms of trying to figure out what was going on. I mean, you've seen the videos mm-hmm. of people running out of the White House. And so I don't want to get into, you know, who did what well or why not. But sure, there was some confusion. Absolutely. You know, when you look at the folks that stayed in the White House, you know, Vice President Cheney and some other members of the cabinet, of the Bush cabinet, lots of confusion. You know, there are lots of calls back and forth from New York and the senior staff. And really, you know, we didn't really know what was going on until we finally got all the aircraft down on the ground.
Because so they really weren't supposed to stay there. I don't know if we can get into this. I mean, the idea was to go to Raven Rock as fast as you possibly could, get, you know. And you're smiling at me because you can only say so much. But I mean, there's been a lot of really interesting articles, and one, the Politico one, if you haven't read it, about like the TikTok from that day is extraordinary mm-hmm. about the confusion, because this was not the game plan, right? The mm-hmm. idea was the continuity of government plan was written during thinking about a Soviet nuclear attack, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. not terrorists running planes into buildings.
Right.
Was it seamless in that respect? It's like, you know what, this is the same basic threat. The White House could be blown up. We need to do something about
it. Well, I mean, certainly the threats are completely different, yeah. you know, but I don't think the execution was any different, though. I mean, there are certain procedures that you follow. There are certain places that you are prepared to go to and establish communications and establish communications with other assets around the world. So I don't think that in itself was a problem. I think it was really just how some of the staff, you know, particularly after about 9:15, 9:20 in the morning, were just told to just leave immediately, some of the non-senior folks. Right. But I think in terms of our program, our emergency action programs that I was responsible for, I would say that I think we were prepared, and though the threat was different, we were fully prepared to go to multiple locations should something have happened to right. the White House. And we had contingencies in place, and so we were ready to go.
We'll be right back after this.
And now a word from our sponsor, SpyCloud, the leader in operationalizing cybercrime analytics. Traditional threat intelligence is a thing of the past. Cyber criminals are stealing vast amounts of credentials, session cookies, and financial data every day, and it's hard to keep up. SpyCloud is the trusted partner businesses turn to fully understand their darknet exposure risk and neutralize threats before it's too late. SpyCloud alerts your organization as soon as an employee or customer's data appears on the darknet, so you can act faster than bad actors to prevent cyber attacks like ransomware, session hijacking, account takeover, and online fraud. With insights from the industry's largest repository of recaptured data, protect the digital identities and systems most important to your business. Get your free corporate darknet exposure report at spycloud.com/cyberwire and see what information criminals have in their hands today. That's spycloud.com/cyberwire.
How much tension was there on 9/12 and 9/13 and 9/14? I mean, a lot of people think of 9/11 as a singular event, like one day, you know, mm-hmm. a couple planes, and then kind of everyone moved on. But for the yeah. National Security Community, the intelligence community, yeah. that was the beginning, not the end, right? That was the beginning of the crazy period because potential for follow-on attacks and other things like that. How much communication is there with CIA, with the intelligence community about potential threats? I know that's probably a big part of the job is finding out what's happening day to day. But there was no business as usual after 9/11, right?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we were devastated like everyone in the nation was. You know, we were shocked. You know, what in the world's going on? And we were on edge for a long period of time. Anytime we got a report in the operations center, in the emergency operations center, or those folks in the Situation Room, we were like, whoa, wait a second, you know, and then we had to calm ourselves down. I mean, that's just kind of the mindset that we were in. So every little thing. So we were prepared.
I mean, a lot of us, you know, we took 9/12 and 9/13 to lick our wounds and try to figure out the world. But you didn't have an opportunity to do
No, we didn't have that opportunity. No, we had to get back to business. We had to be prepared for whatever contingency was coming next. You know, I think the folks that work for me did a great job. I think most of the people, you know, Secret Service and them did a great job. But it did take us a few days to kind of calm down, I mean, and relax a little bit, so to speak. You know, anytime there was, you know, a plane was off course by you know, a couple minutes or you know, not communicating, it was something that we really got spun up on. But,
in many cases, this is not specific to the job, but to broader intelligence. I think we're going to look back and think that we're fortunate that no one else was prepared to take advantage of us during this time. How much of the risk was tunnel vision on 9/12 and 9/13 and 9/14? Because if the NORCs wanted to do something at the time, if Iran wanted to play around at the time, Saddam Hussein's still around if he wanted to do something at the time, this would have been a great opportunity while we're looking, everyone is looking in one direction.
Well, I think all of our adversaries have done that. I mean, if you look at what the North Koreans did, you know, their first nuclear test. If you look at the missile buildup from the Iranians, the militarization of the South China Sea, that didn't start just a couple of years ago. And so I think what's happened is with our nation's laser-like focus on the war on terror, global terrorism, sure, we've taken our eye off the ball. And you have a lot of military commanders now talking about our inadequacies and not being prepared to fight the Russians and the Chinese. That came out the other day in a good report. So, yeah, I certainly do. But I think no country took advantage of us more than the North Koreans did. They saw that our focus was on the Middle East. It was in Afghanistan, some parts of Africa. And they said, the United States is distracted. We're going to put a lot of more money and resources into our WMD program. And I believe that they've done that. Same thing with the Iranians.
Let me ask you about your work at the Citadel. This is a department that just stood up relatively recently. It's about a year and a half old.
It's about a year old.
We're seeing some of these popping up around the country, and it's really interesting to see an academic focus on intelligence policy and intelligence history. What do you think the importance of these kind of programs are? I mean, this is a softball question to a degree, but I like talking to people who are in the same field, basically, as I am, intelligence education. And you know, what their vision of the key importance of these kind of programs?
I mean, in our view, you know, if you look at our department, you know, you look at the professors that we have, and we're focused on multiple learning objectives, but really the one we always focus in on is critical thinking. You know, we're always asking our students, what do you think about this? What is your assessment of this? And more importantly, how did you arrive at that assessment? What is the evidence that you used? And so we spent a lot of time differentiating between opinion and evidence-based facts. And so that's one of the things we try to do. So I think the value of an intelligence education is good because we tend to look at national security events, but we look at it through the laser, you know, vision of an intelligence officer, you know, and how do we get those students prepared? And one of the things that we find is the best way to prepare them for, you know, this type of field, this type of work, is to get them to critically think and always ask themselves why they came to a conclusion, why they came to an assessment. And we also, I'm a big believer in red teaming, because I think far too often in the intelligence community, I've been a little bit critical of this, our assessments are often not accurate, I guess is probably the kind word. And I think a lot of that is because we don't really think like our adversaries do. And so that's one of the things I try to do in my classroom, and so do my colleagues there at the Citadel. And we try to get them to think like, what are the Chinese thinking now? Well, we know that the Chinese look at things in 100-year increments. We look at an election cycle and probably even shorter than that. And so that's the value that we think that intelligence education has, is by critically thinking and thinking like our adversaries, which we believe will make our students very good intelligence officers down the road.
So. Well, that's something that's been borrowed from the military. I mean, thinking about, you know, the Op 4 and trying to kind of be, think like
red
the
team.
Bad guy, right?
Yep. Yep. Technique. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, that's there's whole entire massive centers around the country like NTC and others that are set up for exactly that. So I looked up the areas of concentration for the undergraduates, and one of them stands out. All the other ones are relatively straightforward. There's military intelligence, counterterrorism, business intelligence, general intelligence, and Chinese area studies.
Yes.
That I'm like, well, okay. why pick the Chinese specifically as the one regional area, the one specific country that you guys want to focus on?
Well, when we put together the program, Dr. Jensen and myself and some others, I mean, we looked at where do we see our strategic competitors down the road, and also what infrastructure do we currently have in place? I mean, that was certainly a big part of the decision-making progress. But, you know, we have a lot of courses in our political science department that focus on the Far East and in China. We have a language-intensive program at the Citadel where a Chinese is offered. So we said, well, let's have a Chinese area studies. It's just five courses, but, you know, that's where, so to speak, the action is down the road. I mean, there's nobody in the world that can convince me that looking out 50 to 100 years that the Chinese are not the strategic competitor. We can talk all we want about the Iranians right now and their short-range and medium-range ballistic missiles. We can talk about the North Koreans, their inability to hit the United States still. At least that's my vision or my assessment. But it's really all about the Chinese. And it's not just from a military perspective. It is political and it's economic. If you look at the investments the Chinese are putting into Africa, into South America.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, we've always been okay with them and not to worry because they've been a regional power.
Yes.
Right? They've been kind of, you know, the East Asia thing. But now they're really branching out. They're starting to kind of sow their wild oats.
Oh, yeah, you know. Absolutely. I mean, they're investing heavily in Africa. They're outspending us in Africa. They're investing heavily in some of their shipping lanes going into, you know, through the Indian Ocean. You look at some of the infrastructure and the investments they're making in the Caribbean, and let's look at our home right here in the United States. And so, I mean, they are thinking globally. They want to challenge us. They are competitors. You know, do I think we're going to go to war with China, conventionally speaking, in the next 50 years? No, I don't think that's going to happen. Are we going to continue to be victims of some cyber attacks and penetration and things like that? The answer is yes. When we look at the Russians, when we look at the Iranians, they are all threats and competitors as well. But I look at them more at the regional level. There's only one that can challenge us globally, and that's the Chinese. And mostly because of their economy.
Right. If you put on your big strategic vision intelligence analyst hat, is your warning sign that there might be a military problem coming forward, the buildup of the plan, the Chinese Navy? Is that to me? I mean, you can't challenge us globally. This is not just thinking modern day. This is looking back at World War I and World War II and the idea that the great power competition is really focused on navies clashing places, not necessarily armies. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese could build 100,000 amphibious boats, but they can't get them across the Pacific because the Nimitz are now Ford-class carriers that boop, 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 pick them off one by one.
Right.
But if China churns out 5 or 10 carriers in the next 15 years. Well, they won't because they think carriers are obsolete, which is a whole other issue. But
they're going to have a couple. Yeah, they've got a couple right now, and then the plan is to have 5 of them by 2030. But you're right. I mean, I think they're thinking beyond that. I think you're absolutely correct in that regard. They're thinking beyond that. And so with this, you know, this area denial that I mentioned earlier on, they know that in order to be a global power, they've got to project military forces globally. Well, they have now a base in Djibouti, as many in your audience already know. They're looking to add more bases in Africa. I'll bet you within 10 or 15 years, they'll be operating in South America. They've just done some leasing, by the way, for a space launch facility in Argentina, by the way. And so they've got to have a Navy to project that power. So with 5 carriers, they're getting closer. You know, one of the things, though, that I think a lot of analysts don't understand or I disagree with their assessment is they think that the Chinese Navy it will be on par with the United States Navy in the next 5 or 6 years just because their Navy is now bigger than ours. And I disagree with that. I mean, we have tech superiority. I mean, and we will continue to retain tech superiority for at least 10 or 15 years. There's no doubt about it in my mind. They make strides. They can hack into certain systems. Then we make strides and we counter. And I believe for the foreseeable future, they'll continue to play catch up. But I do believe once they get five carriers, just like as we have been using our carriers for the last 50, 60 years for power projection, not just military, but obviously for our diplomatic and some other efforts that we have, they're going to be doing that with their carriers. I don't think they're building carriers just so they can dominate the South China Sea and the East China Sea. Right. They're building carriers that can operate in the Atlantic.
Right. You don't need a carrier when you have all these air bases that you've built in the last 5 years.
That's a great point. That's absolutely a great point. And they've got air bases in the South China Sea. They're working on long-range bombers. As you know, and as your audience, I'm sure, knows, I mean, this is a country that has over 100 nuclear warheads at this point in time. They're developing anti-satellite technology. They're no slouch. I mean, they would be a difficult fight, but I have no doubt that we would win any conventional combat situation in the Pacific.
Well, you brought up a lot of technology in the last couple minutes, which is a great segue into your book, Into the Shadows, Assassination Corps. We'll get to the specifics in a second, but let me ask you, this is now your second novel, and you're either close to or already finished with a third.
I started another one.
So number four,
yes,
all right.
Yes, sir.
So you've already mentioned Tom Clancy right off the top. That was actually one of my questions, because Clancy seems to be the most, if you look at, talk to other novelists where you're like, oh, you want to be John le Carré, or somebody else like, oh, you want to be Ian Fleming. There's a lot of Clancy in this, right? I mean, kind of is that what inspired you to want to write novels?
Yeah, partly so. You know, I mean, I like the way Clancy infused technology. You know, a lot of it was military, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so I've tried to adapt some of that in my own style. But yeah, I'd be lying to you. I mean, I've said this in other interviews and to other people before and other audiences. You know, I mean, Clancy was an inspiration. I have to admit it. I'm not gonna say it wasn't when I was a teenager. I loved The Hunt for Red October. And so when I decided to try to give this a shot to write, I had him in my mind. And I think part of that is particularly the fourth one I've just started, as crazy as that sound, that's going to be to really honor him and his legacy. So I'm going to put a lot of effort into that one. But for me, it's also just my own personality. You know, I'm a big believer in tech and understanding how technology works and how technology changes the way we view the world. How do we view our adversaries? And so that's why I focus a lot on technology in the books too.
It might be one of the first novels to have the term massant in it, which was, you know, made me smile. Yes.
Hopefully you and some of the folks in your audience, measurements and signatures.
Yes, five other people are going to think it's interesting. No.
Oh, but, I hope so.
So there are obviously many people in the intelligence community focusing on what you talked about, on Chinese politics, economics, leadership. Your character, your main character, is really focusing on more tactical stuff, or also big picture technology. That seems to be kind of down your alley, right? I mean, how much, I guess the question here in this case is, how much is this character based on you, right? Jack Ryan was who Tom Clancy wanted to be.
Right.
But Tom Clancy wasn't a career military intelligence officer, didn't have the background. So is this a Michael Brady surrogate, you know, putting in a little bit? You know?
No, it's just a figment of my imagination, Vince. No. It's a combination of many things. I mean, I think you expressed it correctly. I mean, yes, he's looking for some tactical information. But keep in mind, I mean, there is a strategic element to that, and that is, you know, why was this launch? You know, what happened? What's the intent behind it? And so, but yeah, there's a little bit in there of me, but it's just, I was talking to an author recently. I said, you know, I just let the characters take me, and I've let Michael Brennan take me where Michael Brennan's going to go.
Right.
And, but it's mostly made up. So.
Yeah, no, I mean, your storyline is, you know, to rip off Law and Order, it's ripped from the headlines, right? The idea of ASAT technology and, you know, technological intelligence focused on capabilities and future capabilities.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you about real versus fantasy world, because you use several real life people in this novel, leadership of certain places, and then some just so slightly tweaked. I mean, your director of national intelligence is Stephen Coates.
Correct. Yes.
So what were
and I just met Director Coates a few months ago. He's down at the Citadel and talked to us and gave some of his time. So he's a good man. So
I'm wondering where, what, from a writing a novel perspective, like, where did you make those decisions? Because there are a lot of novelists who will put something modern day, but will change the names of presidents or change the names of everything else.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think if your audience were to check out the book or even the first one, I mean, I've tried to make my books compelling, modern, and as realistic as possible. And I think that starts at least with the settings and then some of the principal characters like the president. So President Trump is in book two. President Obama was in book one because that was focused mostly in 2014. But you know, when you add in these other names, you know, I throw those in there just to, you know, I didn't want it to be direct because I'm never going to say anything negative or positive about the president in any of these books. I'll give some perspectives and how I think they might communicate. And you know, if you see, you know, when you read the book, you know, you saw President Trump have quite a bit of dialogue in the Situation Room. But I never wrote anything that might be disparaging or negative or anything like that. I kept that, you know, kept that out of it. But then some other characters, you know, our national security advisor and some other folks, I made those close to it because there were some flaws that they had. So
yo, what's interesting is your unique background. It looks like from reading this that it helped you a lot because you obviously have the experience as an intelligence officer, so you can write kind of the day-to-day. Yeah. But also looking at, like, White House inner office stuff as well, kind of like how – the leadership would react, and even giving people dialogue, you're not just making up out of thin air. You've got some background to understand how this relationship works.
Yeah, I mean, I was very fortunate to sit in on some things, you know, and hear some of these policymakers talk. And so, you know, one of the things I did when I started this project with book one and now Assassination Court book two is I wanted to make it interesting but believable and realistic. And is this how a president would really speak in a Situation Room? I mean, is it all, you know, is it all bluster, you know? But I've found that presidents and senior policymakers are very straight and to the point. And that's how some of that dialogue is built around the Situation Room when the president is speaking. And how Oliver Tanner briefs him, who's one of our characters. You know, very short, to the point, direct, answer the questions, and not a lot of Hollywood, you know.
Well, and I think, I mean, even
going on there.
Yeah, I mean, I think even those that might read this might think that you almost overprotect Donald Trump in this case. But all indications are that when the serious stuff is being discussed, that there's serious conversations and not necessarily what you see either from his Twitter feed or from the kind of the caricature of him that's done. I mean, and that's true for Obama also of a lot of people got on him because he was such a kind of deep thinker.
Yeah.
And some people even use that derogatorily, the idea of he just thought too much, right? He didn't act.
Yeah, he was slow.
Pondered. But when the rubber hits the road in these Situation Rooms, I mean, look, the most characterized president, certainly in our lifetimes, is George W. Bush, right? The bumbling Texan and all that, and that, the dumb guy. But every indication is on 9/11. I mean, that's when the shit hits the fan.
Yeah,
is when you see kind of serious stuff coming out of these people.
Yeah, President Bush was fantastic, first great leader. There's no doubt about it. It's been said probably 100 times, and I've got nothing else to add on that. But yeah, I mean, you make a great point. I mean, look, you know, one of the things I pride myself as a professor is when I teach my classes to my students, they don't know if I'm a Republican or a Democrat. You know, as an intel officer, you got to check that at the door, you know? And so I kind of, that goes into my writing. So when I write about President Trump, I may or may not agree with a decision that he's made, or I may or may not agree with something he said on Twitter, but who am I, you know, to challenge that? I'm a fiction writer. I'm a professor. And so I'm going to portray the president how I think a president would be portrayed in a real situation in the Situation Room. And let other people, you know, support him or challenge him.
Whether you like it or not, he's the decision maker.
That's
right?
Exactly,
I mean, that's
right.
The idea is that, you know, he's the one that's going to make the final, especially when you're talking about military operations or intelligence operations. You know, you can be a Republican and Democrat, a pro-Trump or anti-Trump, but that's he is going to be making the final decision.
Yeah, and I just wanted to portray him in several of those scenes and you know, what type of questions, you know, he would likely ask. You know, how long are these briefings? Those briefings are short. That's how most briefings are. Yeah. And so I didn't want to come across as portraying and being pro-Trump or negative Trump. There's enough divisiveness over that in the country. Far be it from me to talk about it. I just stick to the story and let the characters go.
One thing that some readers may find frustrating about this book, but I loved the fact. I think you do a really good job in illustrating the complexity of the region because this is not as straightforward. Anyone who likes the straightforwardness of the Cold War were pulling their hair out because of how complex the East Asian region is. Mm-hmm. And some alliances aren't necessarily as tight as we may assume.
Correct.
In real life. And there's a lot of real life misunderstanding about this, like mm-hmm. China rein in North Korea. It's like,
yeah, it doesn't work that way.
Right, it doesn't necessarily work that way.
And they you have kind of, their own self-interest.
You highlight a lot of that kind of the PRC-DPRK relationship in the book really well. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you talk a little, either through the book or through the real world, about the complexity of that relationship? Because it's not as straightforward as people think.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, the best thing I can say is that, you know, usually when people think of the Chinese-North Korean relationship, you think of big brother, yep. You got little brother. You know, it goes back to, you know, the Korean War, this strategic buffer, which I call nonsense at this point in time. The conventional wisdom, and I still hear pundits talking about this on television, is that that North Korea provides the strategic buffer from ground forces from the United States. 30 years ago, I would have bought it. You know, I don't buy it anymore. I don't think they look at that at all. I think Kim Jong-un is becoming more hard, more difficult to rein in, especially if you're looking at it from a Chinese perspective. They have leverage over North Koreans. About 80% of the North Korean economy is completely dependent on the Chinese. But now that you've got a new leader with Kim Jong-un, he seems to be fairly brash, he's got a lot of confidence, and he's also sitting on nuclear warheads. Now, as I've written before, do I think he has the ability to hit the United States with an intercontinental ballistic missile? The answer is no. If you look at the telemetry data, if you look at some of the data that's come out, I don't think he can do it. But the fact is that he has conducted 6 nuclear tests. So we know he's got the capability to do it. And so he's the Chinese are looking at him much more seriously than they would have, let's say, his father, his grandfather. But it's very complex. But I don't think the Chinese need the North Koreans as much as they used to.
Well, he may not be able to hit Hawaii or L.A., but he can hit Tokyo.
He can certainly hit Seoul, Guam. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, Guam.
Absolutely right.
Guam. Who cares about Guam?
Well, yeah. I don't know.
Sorry, that was my one day.
I think some of the folks in the Navy
they
might have some issues with that.
Okinawa, too, right?
Oh, God. Don't get... You're going to get us in trouble, Vince.
I always get myself in trouble. So let me wrap this up by asking you... I ask this question a lot of novelists, mainly because I'm interested in it, because I thought I'm never going to write a novel, but if I did, and it was something overseas, even though I visited lots and lots and lots of countries, either through the army or otherwise, I'd have a hard time describing the setting. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this is set in places like Jakarta and others. Mm-hmm. Did you write what you know, or did you go and research? Did you kind of...
I don't have the research funds to go to Jakarta, Vince. I don't have that. So, no, I mean, most of what I did in the book, because there's so many different locations, is just a lot of research and just reading, you know. I mean, reading blogs for people who are in Jakarta, reading, you know, travel sites, you know, and you pick up on some things. Man, it smells in parts of Jakarta. We don't think that here in the West, but we do. So, no, I mean, I'm with a smaller publisher, with Waldorf Publishing. You know, they support me 100%, but... I don't get a lot of travel money at this point in time in my career, so hopefully that'll change down the road.
Right, exactly. So how do people find this book?
Oh, you can find it in all the retail outlets. They can find it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Target. I mean, anywhere that they sell books. If it's not in the store at the time, they can order it. It's found in most independent bookstores as well. It's been distributed overseas, and so basically any major retail outlet, they'll have the ability to just pull up the title and the name, and they'll be able to order it.
And if they've read the first two and can't wait for the third one, when's the scheduled date?
Well,
the
tentative date is November 1st, 2019. Okay. And so we're hoping to get that. This one will be a reunion, of Michael Brennan and one of the characters in book one. And it'll focus on a plot surrounding Hezbollah. Okay. So... based on what's going on in the news, it'll probably be timely again, so, unfortunately.
Right.
So, yeah, November 1st, 2019.
So the book that is out now is Into the Shadows Assassination Corps. The author is Michael Brady. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here today on SpyCast.
Vince, thank you so much. It was an honor and privilege. Thank you very much.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution to help support future educational programming. Please visit spymuseum.org and click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.